Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an alcohol conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Alcohol, as in E-T-O-H, a little wine, beer, whiskey, tequila from Mexico, or arak from the Middle East. My listeners know I like learning from history. The history of alcohol dates back to prehistoric times. 13,000-year-old beer was found by researchers in Israel. Jars dating to 7,000 BC in China revealed fermented beverages or alcohol. Alcohol's been around for a while. Fast forward to colonial America, people drank 7 gallons of alcohol per year, per person. That was at a time when water contamination was common and alcohol was frankly safer. Then came the infamous Prohibition era of 1920 to 1933. Alcohol was the evil, blamed for cirrhosis, addiction, family violence, and political corruption. Speakeasies replaced the saloons, and bootleg alcohol caused worse methanol poisoning that led to blindness. Today, alcohol continues to cause cirrhosis and violence, but we have decent regulations. We have some protection for children. You cannot sell or advertise to them. We have some potency limits. You can't sell 100% proof alcohol. We have some protections against drunk driver. And we have some quality standards, and people don't get lead or methanol poisoning from legal alcohol. We have warning labels, and pregnant women know to stay away from alcohol. Or is that true? We're going to learn more. To learn more about alcohol and what we can learn from today's drug and alcohol era, I reach out to Dr. David Jernigan. Dr. David Jernigan is a professor of health law, policy, and management at Boston University School of Public Health. He is best known for his action research approach for alcohol advertising and promotion and its influence on young people. He uses research to change policy nationally and internationally. I met Dr. Jernigan at the Oregon Cannabis Policy Summit, where he applied his knowledge of alcohol to the current issues of cannabis. To learn more about Dr. David Jernigan, check out the High Truths show notes. Dr. David Jernigan, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you.
I'm excited to have you. I think we're going to have a fun conversation. We want to learn all about alcohol and not from like a which wine is the best kind of discussion.
Yeah.
But let's talk about your professional journey. Tell us a little bit about that. How did it come to the issue of alcohol?
Sure. It's an odd story. I got into this because I could type 95 words a minute. I dropped out of graduate school. I was temping, and I got a job as the temporary secretary for a brand new alcohol policies project that was opening up at San Francisco General Hospital. 6-week gig. Finished it, hired the permanent secretary, and the guy running it needed a briefing paper written for the state legislature in a week. He offered me $1,000. I said, sure. I wrote it. He read it. He said, can I hire you? Name your price. And we worked together for 13 years, and we're still really, really good friends. So that's how I got started. My personal alcohol
story. All because you took typing in high school.
That's right. My parents did not drink. My mother was part of the nurses study. And when the word started coming out that a half a glass of wine was good for your heart, she, being upwardly mobile, was thrilled and felt terribly sophisticated to start having a half a glass of wine before bed. Before she died, she developed precancerous esophageal lesions. There weren't any other risk factors. She never smoked or anything. Who knows? It was the alcohol. That's not what killed her. But anyway, that's my mother. My father would have a beer once a year with his students and then store the beer in the basement, which showed you how much he knew about beer. So we were not a drinking household, but I went to Dartmouth College for 2 years. And that was certainly a drinking environment. And then I transferred to Harvard, where long before I got involved in any of this, I was appalled. My department had a seminar on Thursday afternoons from 4:30 to 6, and all they served was sherry, and I would watch people fall asleep. So I actually lobbied to get sparkling water served in addition to the sherry. But I got into this for quixotic reasons. I stayed in it because it turns out to be a really great issue. I'm trained as a sociologist because I'm interested in everything. And it turns out just about everything that I was interested in, alcohol touches. And I've stayed in it because this is a product that kills 2.6 million people a year, 178,000 people a year in the US. Anything that's that deadly, I guess it's worth spending time on.
Wow, that's great. And it's a great story. And we met together in Oregon. They talked about, you know, alcohol and cannabis summit. And then you're off to the Philippines. So your alcohol expertise gets you all over the world?
Yes, I've done lots of work for the World Health Organization, worked with them since the mid-90s. I've consulted for the World Bank, and I'm currently an advisor to a project working on alcohol policies in Mexico, Brazil, Kenya, and the Philippines.
Well, that sounds like fun.
It is great fun. It's very rewarding. It's heartbreaking because the situation with alcohol is the fewer resources that are there to catch people, the worse the consequences are. So all over the world, even though poor people and poor communities drink less than wealthier countries, wealthier communities, wealthier people, if you drink and you're lower income, the consequences will be much more visible. And they tend to be worse. We call this the alcohol harm paradox.
And I don't know why I'm asking you this, but when you go to these meetings where you're discussing alcohol policies and, you know, you're done with the meeting and you're going out to dinner, do people drink?
Some of my colleagues drink. I don't. And I've been challenged about it over the years. And the answer that I've come up with that never gets any pushback is I say to people, well, I like to keep my wits about me.
That's good.
Nobody pushes back.
And is it because you just don't like it? Is it?
I am a very cheap drunk. Mm-hmm. I have almost no tolerance because I've never drunk very much. So I really feel it, and it's not a pleasant feeling.
Yeah.
But more than that, I just know way too much about this particular product. I've been working on it for 38 years. And what I usually say to people is, I know more about it than anybody really should. This is a product that's related to more than 200 disease and injury conditions in the human body. It's the all over the world, the number one cause of death and disability among people between the ages of 15 and 45. Unlike tobacco, it tends to kill and disable younger in life. And that's why we rack up so many years of life lost. It is a major factor in productivity. In addition to loss of life and loss of those resources to society, to families, et cetera, the phenomena like presenteeism, which is when people are at work, but they're still suffering under the effects of the weekend. That hurts our ability to be productive, to compete, to have successful careers. Not to mention all the damage that alcohol does to those around the drinker. You don't hear a lot about interpersonal violence related to tobacco, but you hear a lot about it related to alcohol. And in general, the situation with alcohol is if there's a situation where violence is possible and you add alcohol, it's like pouring gasoline on a lit fire.
As an emergency physician, I can attest to that. But it also kind of reminds me like the irony of it, because if you take a group of, you know, nurses, doctors, techs work in an emergency department where a lot of our business are the consequences to alcohol, after hours, you'll see the same staff at the bar.
Yeah, it's remarkable. We are way behind on the health education curve regarding alcohol. Many, many people enjoy it. But also what's important to remember is that, again, alcohol consumption rises with education and with income. So if you're hanging out with doctors and nurses, they are more highly educated than the rest of the population. They are exactly the group that is more likely to be drinking.
Wait, and why is that? Because it's expensive?
Because they're higher educated, they have a higher income, it's a luxury good, and it's become part of middle, upper middle, and owning class culture. It is a mark of sophistication. It's like tobacco used to be in the 50s.
I mean, if you go to, you know, really fancy model homes, and you always see a wine cellar.
Yeah.
That's part of the thing. All right. So you are the expert in alcohol through and through. Let's take us through the history lesson. Let's start with not all the way back to prehistoric times and biblical era of people drinking alcohol, but let's start with prohibition. Alcohol was causing a lot of problems in the country. Like you said, the saloons.
Let me go back a little further than that, if you'll forgive me.
Okay, go ahead.
Which is, let's look at the people who founded this country. They drank a lot. Water wasn't safe.
George Washington and...
Yeah, fermented and distilled beverages were. So they drank a whole lot. And then in the 19th century in this country, consumption moderated some, but it started ticking up again towards the end of the 19th century and really early in the 20th century. At the same time, you had the temperance movement gaining strength over the 19th century. And temperance was originally about, it was a movement in solidarity with the addict. It was, I will not participate in this industry, in this set of behaviors, because it causes so much suffering. So that was originally, it was an individual pledge of principle. And in the late 19th and particularly the early 20th century, that morphs into prohibition. And prohibition was heavily funded by the big industrialists in this country. The Industrial Revolution was happening, and they were really worried about the impact of alcohol on the productivity of their workers. So they heavily funded it. It's incredibly well organized. The Anti-Saloon League is what it was called. And it's important to remember that that was the main prohibition organization, the Anti-Saloon League. They weren't anti-alcohol. They were anti the saloons. And the reason for that is because the saloons had become the place for voting, for getting a job, for so many functions in the community. And the industry was vertically integrated. So the producers owned the distributors and owned the saloons. That gave the industry a whole lot of political power. And so it's important to understand that prohibition in this country, as throughout the world, was actually a movement against the liquor machine more than against liquor itself. And there's a terrific history by a book by a historian at Villanova that has just came out like 2 or 3 years ago. It's really, really clarified this. The U.S. experience wasn't the anomaly that it's painted as, and it wasn't caused by a lot of the things that people have pointed to. You know, one of the theories is this was resident population reacting to immigrants, because supposedly the Irish and the Italians were coming in and drinking. And there's not good evidence for that. This was a movement to reduce the power of the industry over daily life, in addition to its power to cause enormous harm.
Wasn't it carried by people of faith, the Christian cause?
It was. Those same people of faith were carrying votes for women, anti-Jim Crow. This was, yes, faith-led, but it was also part of a much larger progressive movement. Carrie Nation, who often gets made fun of. She's a tiny woman, about 4'9", and she was a crusader for all sorts of things, including the rights of Black people. She donated much of the proceeds from her researchers, from her speeches to organizations in the Black community. If she went and spoke at a church and they wouldn't let Black people in, she would leave the church. So it's important to understand progressive is not this weird anomaly. Prohibition is not this weird anomaly. It was part and parcel of the progressive movement of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, not only in the US, but all over the world. Frederick Douglass was a temperance person. Vladimir Lenin was pro-temperance.
And it's interesting to say the word progressive, because maybe today's progressive is thought to be very different. So when you're saying progressive in those days, the word progressive meant people who wanted prohibition. Progressive today.
But also, it's people who wanted right votes for women. It was people who wanted Black people to be treated better. It was a very similar coalition.
But they wanted no alcohol?
They also identified alcohol as part of the social problems that they were trying to address. So we got prohibition, we got the Volstead Act, and it had huge loopholes in it. Huge loopholes, the biggest of which was people were allowed to produce and consume for home consumption.
I like the part where the doctors were allowed to give alcohol for your cough.
Yes, and alcohol was part of many medicines. So many people were going to the doctor to get their alcohol. The interesting thing that happened with prohibition, though, is prior to prohibition, alcohol taxes were 30% of the federal budget. So when prohibition happened, the federal government lost that income. And what they did to replace it was they increased in a very large way the income tax. And there weren't the kinds of exceptions, workarounds that you have today. That income tax hit hardest the very industrialists who had funded the drive towards prohibition. So in the mid-1920s, the story you get told is, you know, organized crime and blah, blah, and that was happening. But at the same time, Pierre DuPont, Alfred Sloan, who ran GM, these guys were getting heavily hit by the income tax because there was no more alcohol tax. So they turn against prohibition and start funding the drive towards repeal. So in 1933, we get repeal. And
bad things, before the repeal, other bad things happened with prohibition, right? The moonshine,
Yeah, you hear a lot about that, but it's what you don't hear about is the good things that happen. And again, I'm not a prohibitionist, but this is part of the public health history. Both liver cirrhosis rates and alcohol dependence rates dropped through the ceiling, through the cellar, almost overnight. And
so prohibition worked for public health.
It did. It did. It helped people who had bad livers not tip over into mortality. So in 33, we get the repeal, and we set things up very carefully post-repeal so that the bad things that were happening prior to prohibition wouldn't happen again. Three main pillars of that. The first is high taxes. Okay, the federal government was going to get that money back, and sure enough, after prohibition, they didn't get rid of the income tax, but alcohol taxes were once again 9% of federal revenues. Limits on advertising. And the distillers just said right out of the gate, we will never advertise. They wrote it into their code. They said, we're just not going to advertise. We understand we're not going to advertise. They quietly changed that code in 1996, but that's a whole lot later. And then the third piece.
Right, because football is full of beer commercials.
Yes. The third piece was control over availability. And this was done in several ways. First, they banned vertical integration in the industry. So in the US, we have three tiers. A producer cannot own a wholesaler who cannot in turn own a retailer. So we have that. States were given the option to go in the monopoly direction or the licensing direction, and 17 of them still have monopoly systems over alcohol. This is copying what was common and still is in the Nordic countries, where the government takes control of some aspect of the alcohol supply. And then there were limits set on when it could be bought and sold, where it could be bought and sold, how many licenses would be given out, and all that. This whole structure, I teach this in public health school, it's a classic example of implementation failure. Because they put it in place, and then everybody promptly forgot why they put it in place.
You mean, is that why we have some dry counties and some not?
It is why you still have some dry counties, although fewer and fewer of those. But it's also why, I mean, in Massachusetts today, we have more places to buy alcohol than we have Dunkin' Donuts. The controls, and I mean, the taxes, it's ridiculous. Again, in my home state, Massachusetts, we last raised the tax on alcohol in 1980 when Jimmy Carter was president, and the number one song was Blondie's Call Me. Since then, it has lost close to 75% of its value because it's a flat tax. It doesn't rise with inflation. It's based on how much alcohol is in the bottle, and that hasn't changed. So the ability to use taxes to reduce demand is basically gone. At this point, you go to a corner store in any city that allows corner stores to sell alcohol, and the cheapest form of liquid will not be the soda pop. It won't be the orange juice. It won't be the milk. It won't be the water. It'll be the beer. And that's the result of the taxes. So, and then we have the explosion of advertising. And these days we have the algorithms. So I spent 15 years running something called the Center on Alcohol Marketing and Youth, where we monitored youth exposure to alcohol marketing. We bought the Nielsen data. We knew how much kids were seeing based on the best data available. You can't buy those data anymore for the platforms. The platforms know how much kids are seeing this, but we can't get it. And those algorithms are so incredibly sophisticated. They keep kids on the platforms, and they also interfere with recovery.
What do you mean what do you mean by these platforms?
Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, Snapchat. These are privately owned platforms. And we have basically seeded the public square to private companies that are making enormous amounts of money by keeping us on their platforms. I don't have a problem with that until it interfaces with addiction. And it clearly does here.
Are you saying that these social media platforms are promoting alcohol to children?
Well, I'll tell you a story, okay? We do a periodic global alcohol policy conference, and just before the start of the pandemic in 2020, we held it in Dublin, Ireland. There was a group of about 15 high school students who came from Texas to that conference. They landed in Ireland and they got on their phones and searched Global Alcohol Policy Conference. And the rest of the time that they were in Ireland, they were being served alcohol ads on their phones because they used the word alcohol in a Google search. And companies have bought that word. So yeah. If you're a person in recovery or trying to get into recovery and you're trying to find resources and you do an alcohol search, you will start to get served alcohol ads. This is just something that makes no sense.
What's the solution to that?
There's a couple. One is, as a researcher, we would love for these platforms to make their data more available so that we can actually track who's seeing what and document the extent of the problem. Beyond that, I mean, people like me, I'd prefer, you know, Facebook, they can decide who advertises on their program, on their platform, and who doesn't. And I wish they'd just say, nah, we're not going to take alcohol ads. They've done it with tobacco, but they don't do it with alcohol.
Wait, so you won't get tobacco ads on Facebook
and Instagram,
but you will get alcohol.
You may get some leakage with influencers on Instagram, but anyway, I mean, these platforms are private, so there's no First Amendment issue there. Because there's, you know, it's a private platform. Facebook can decide who talks and who doesn't.
But if we had a national policy of not advertising alcohol or drugs to minors, then wouldn't they be held accountable for that?
One would hope, but it's very difficult. We find that boundary, advertising to minors, is incredibly porous. And the industry has voluntary codes that say they won't do that, says they won't use content that's attractive to minors. But, you know, I've got an ad I show in my presentations where they're quoting Dr. Seuss. I mean, this is all voluntary.
Yeah. So that's an issue. All right. So back to learning from history.
Yeah.
The reason prohibition failed is why? Even though we had good outcomes, you said we had good public health outcomes, yeah, but people say, oh, well, people, or maybe that's...
We couldn't keep the bulk of the population with us. And when I teach this in my courses, I usually get my TA up and I have him or her dance with me, because I say, look, alcohol policy is a dance with the population. You can't go much farther ahead of where the population is. You have to keep them with you. And prohibition in this country, it was moving further ahead of where the population was. Compare that to what we've done with tobacco. We don't have tobacco prohibition, but we put in places all sorts of things. And, you know, here, I mean, the tobacco people have learned so much from alcohol. I was just on a call yesterday with a bunch of tobacco folks trying to still keep learning from tobacco around what we've done around retail controls, because tobacco's a little behind there. But they've learned so much from us. We don't have tobacco prohibition, but we've put in place measures like high taxes, like limits on advertising and marketing, like limits on availability that have...
But we also made smoking uncool. It's not cool to smoke.
Well, getting rid of the advertising was really helpful in doing that.
Yeah.
Because what the advertising does is it shapes culture. That's what advertising is. It's the intentional shaping.
But we put in ads, and I'll, you know, Brooke Shields, it's like kissing an ashtray. You know, we put in ads that made it uncool. Yeah.
No, the counter ads on tobacco were terrific. They were funded early on by big state tobacco taxes. And we would love to see something similar happen for alcohol, but we can't get the states to increase their alcohol taxes. Most states stopped increasing their alcohol taxes in the early 70s and have just let them sit. So they're out of date almost everywhere.
So it failed because the population wasn't ready for that stringency. They didn't dance that way. By the way, it'd be fun to be in your dancing class, I think.
I argue it was too much too fast.
Too much. All right. But some good things came out of it. Like, I mean, again, as a physician, I could probably get alcohol anywhere in the world and not worry about it having methanol and going blind. Somehow there were good regulations in quality of alcohol. You know,
And there still are in much of the world, those few examples of alcohol poisonings. And it's really, I mean, it would make me laugh if it weren't so tragic, okay? Because you hear an enormous amount about methanol poisoning.
Yeah.
Like the case that just happened with Travelers. I forget the country, but it just came out this week. But you don't hear anything about the deaths that are happening every day, every week from ethanol poisoning, which are far greater than the deaths from methanol poisoning.
I mean, that's true, but before alcohol, during prohibition, we would get a lot more of the methanol problems, which we don't anymore. Like you said, it's rare.
Yeah,
I mean, we still have problems. We're not getting that problem.
We got a huge problem with ethanol poisoning. Yes. I'm just pulling up the figures for you.
No, I work in the ER. I could show you my ER. I hate working New Year's because I'm just like just one sober person this whole ER.
I mean, alcohol poisoning. Last year, CDC estimates 2,600 deaths from alcohol poisoning, and then an additional 19,000 deaths from poisonings from other substances that wouldn't have happened if the person hadn't been drinking.
Right. Like driving and running in front of a train and all the...
No. That's just poisonings. In other words, they ingested other things while they were drunk.
Okay.
One of the biggest categories of alcohol-related deaths is alcohol-related poisonings.
All right. So anything good come out? What are the good things that you see in alcohol regulation? Potency limits, right? You can't buy 100%.
Yep. Uh-huh. Well, actually, we had to pass a law in Maryland banning 190 proof alcohol. And as soon as we did, the industry came out with 189 proof. So you actually can, you know, that's basically 95% alcohol. So you can actually buy that in a lot of states. I mean,
how about quality? You're not going to get lead in your wine?
You don't know that, actually, because the wineries are not required to put ingredients on the label. They use all sorts of chemicals to stabilize the grapes, things like formaldehyde. But you don't know that because they don't have to put ingredients on their label.
Okay, I'm trying to find something good here. Help me out.
Good luck to you.
Anything good came out with alcohol regulation? Okay, how about warning labels? Warning labels?
Yeah, when the alcohol warning label passed in 1991, I said to the press, Congress passed a warning label, not an eye test. That label violates everything we've learned from tobacco about what an effective warning label should be. It's a joke.
Okay. I'll give you that.
Keep trying. So let me word this a different way, okay?
How about, I know one. I think women who are pregnant know not to drink.
I disagree.
In general. There are some outliners, but in general, that message is out that it's not good for you.
I wish that were the case, but fetal alcohol spectrum disorders are still the, I think, third leading preventable cause of birth defects in this country.
All right. You're killing me. No regulation, potency, quality, pregnancy. Okay. I got one. How about the standards? The standards of drinking, what NIAAA did, that like this is a standard drink.
I worked as a bartender, okay? I worked as a bartender when I was in college. If I like you, this is a standard drink, okay? I pour it a long time. If I don't like you, I pour it for 3 seconds.
No, but there are, I mean, okay, there's always exceptions in the way of real life, but the standards that are created according to the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse sets a standard, right? The 2 ounces for liquor, 4 ounces for wine, one, you know, regular beer, that's considered one.
It's an ounce and a half for spirits, 5 ounces for wine, 12 ounces for malt beverages. The point here is I'm not defending prohibition. I'm defending the strong regulations we put in place after prohibition, that if we had left those in place, we would have a much safer, healthier environment around alcohol than we do today. But what's happened in the nearly 100 years since repeal is that those regulations have eroded. And so we face a situation now where alcohol is clearly the drug of choice, where the alcohol industry has enormous political power. They have 280 registered lobbyists in Washington, D.C. That's one lobbyist for every 2 members of Congress. It's what I call a very good teacher-to-student ratio. They donate millions and millions of dollars to political campaigns at the federal and at the state level. And again, these are all things that weren't supposed to happen.
What would you like to see come back?
Number one, the high taxes. I mean, they've been so effective in tobacco, and they've funded all sorts of good public health activity. So certainly the high taxes, the limits on availability.
I don't think people would like you for that. People love their beer and wine. You're going to tax that just to go to government?
Just to go to healthcare, just to go to making sure that children can get healthcare, you know, There's all sorts of good things that money can fund.
Would high taxes to alcohol, wouldn't it just, you know, help the rich guy because they're going to still have their wine and not?
So the rich guy will pay the bulk of the tax because they'll continue to buy the most. But actually, the biggest benefits will be in a poor family or a poor community because they'll feel it the most. So that preventive effect will be felt the most there. Furthermore, the services that the taxes will pay for are much more likely to be used by lower than higher income people. So it's a win-win for poor people. And frankly, when we polled taxes this summer, alcohol taxes in Massachusetts, the poll question was, I think, a dime a drink increase, and the money was going to go to alcohol and other drug and mental health treatment and prevention, domestic violence prevention, suicide prevention, and wraparound services for children and families in K through 12 schools. Two-thirds of the population said, yeah, that'd be great. And the group most in favor of it, 79% of people making less than $20,000 a year favored the tax.
Yeah, interesting. And did it go? Didn't go.
It'll be a 2, if not a 4-year campaign. These are a steep hill.
You remind me, the very first campaign I ever worked with, I don't know if I was a doctor yet or my residency, it was a nickel a drink in California. They were trying to do nickel a drink.
Right? Yeah, I worked on that campaign.
Oh, did I? So I did too. It was the first campaign I ever did anything. It was cool. Yeah. I was a young ER doctor or resident. And it didn't go.
1991. Well, I'll tell you what we got out of that campaign, okay? Yeah. The industry was so scared that we were going to win that they put their own penny a drink on the ballot as well. Both of those ballot initiatives passed, but the next legislative session, the legislature raised the tax by penny a drink because they said the industry's willing to put this on the ballot so we can get away with it. So we got a tiny increase. We also diverted at least $40 million from the marketing budget because that's what it cost them to defeat us.
Yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, it hasn't come back.
I was part of the campaign in Maryland in 2010, where we added a 3% sales tax onto alcohol, and that did pass. That's raising upward of $130 million a year. It does rise with inflation. That's what we like about sales taxes. And it's going to all sorts of good things. And we've evaluated that. It led to a 3.5% drop in consumption, 6% drop in alcohol-impaired drivers on Maryland roadways. And this one nobody believes, but it's what the data show, a 24% drop in gonorrhea cases.
For alcohol tax?
Yeah, the alcohol tax, the increase in the alcohol tax.
The alcohol tax decreased gonorrhea.
It did. The pathway is pretty clear. You drink less, you have less stupid sex, you're less at risk for sexually transmitted diseases. And we found that not only in Maryland, my colleagues also found that when Illinois did a big tax increase. It's an easy one to study.
All right, so you are a big tax guy.
I never thought I would be, but here I am.
All right, and does that mean you're into big taxes for everything or just specifically for alcohol and drugs?
The evidence is so strong for alcohol and the history is so bad. I mean, these taxes just, they don't work the way they're supposed to work anymore because we haven't kept up. We haven't modernized them. So that's why I'm a fan of the alcohol taxes. Way back in 1989, Surgeon General C. Everett Koop said the single most effective way of reducing alcohol problems was raising the alcohol tax. And the research has just gotten stronger since then.
And we assume that worked with tobacco, right? When a pack of cigarettes costs, what, $4 or $5?
Yes,
it makes people want to quit.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So the other interesting thing that you do, I thought that would be fun to share, is you go to Reddit and people ask you questions about alcohol. Who is your audience when you do that?
I have no idea. I've done it once and I'm not going to do it again because you get trolled. And I had one guy who just wouldn't let go. And the thing he wouldn't let go of is it's the evidence about whether drinking alcohol is actually safe, quote unquote. And, you know, driving a car inherently isn't safe. The minute you get behind the wheel of a car, you raise your risk of being in a car crash. And it's a similar thing for alcohol. We used to think that small amounts of alcohol were good for health. In the last 10 years, that literature has basically collapsed. They were faulty studies, a lot of which were funded by the alcohol industry itself. So at this point, we know that for things like female breast cancer, no amount of alcohol is safe. The minute you start drinking, you raise your risk. My take is people deserve to know that so that you can make your own risk calculations. I'm not saying don't drink. I'm not saying don't drive a car.
You sound like me. You sound like me and marijuana. I'm not telling you not to do, but just make an informed decision.
Well, it is a standard public health line. What I usually say is there are many reasons that people may decide to drink. Your health just should never be one of them.
All right. That's fair. What were some of the questions that people asked you, though, on that?
That was one that he really wouldn't let go of. Okay. The other one, and the question I get everywhere, no matter who I'm talking to, is the Europe question, which is, well, gee, you know, Europe has lower drinking ages than we have, and they don't have a problem. Isn't just the problem our 20-year-old drinking age? We make it forbidden fruit. And there's absolutely no evidence to support that. In fact, the countries in Europe that have lower drinking ages than we tend to have much larger youth drinking problems than we have. We have comparable surveys of 10th graders, 15 and 16 year olds in the US and over 30 European countries. And when it comes to prevalence of drinking, we are second from the bottom. What 21 does is it delays initiation into alcohol use by our young people. And from what we know now about the maturation of the human brain, that's a really good thing.
Right. I always say that 21, 18-year-olds, those are, you know, legal ages, but the science age is 25.
Yeah, absolutely. Agreed.
All right. Youth prevention. What's the most effective policy? How about the parents not drinking? What?
Taxes.
Taxes. Everything comes back to taxes.
Listen, the research is really solid there. Young people are even more price sensitive than the rest of the population. You raise the price.
But they just take it from their parents' liquor cupboard. I thought you would say like an example of the parents.
Parents are really important. And
like, you know, because if kids, some parents are like, ugh, I can't wait to have a beer with my son, right? If that's your goal, then of course that's.
And, you know, oddly enough, there's a myth that college drinking results from inexperienced drinkers showing up on college campus. In fact, what we found is that the young people, college students who have trouble with alcohol on campus tend to be the ones whose parents let them drink in high school. So parents are absolutely critical. Parents are key role models, and certainly the single greatest influence on a young person's drinking is going to be their parents drinking. But more than that, again,
you want to just tax the parents.
No, another big influence is the general alcohol policy environment in which they grow up. And I have colleagues who have looked at the alcohol policies in place across the 50 states and scored them. And the higher the alcohol policy restrictiveness score, the less youth drinking you will find.
Wait, say that again. Less restrictive is less.
The more restrictive the score is, the higher the score, and you get more points for the more restrictive policies you have. So if your taxes are higher, if you have a monopoly and allow fewer places.
You know, but I guess let me ask you the Europe model. Like, you know, I grew up in a traditional Jewish family. We have wine on the table every Friday night. And I was given like a little thing. I said, I hated it. And so it's like, okay, well, just put your finger in it, put it in your mouth so you could get the blessing. And so I grew up, that's how I grew up. Not just me, but a lot of Jewish people grow up with alcohol on the table. I don't think our rate of alcoholism is
No, high. But that's not what I'm referring to when I'm referring to parents drink, allowing kids to drink at home. The mm-hmm. parents I'm talking about are the ones who think, oh, I'll host the underage drinking party at our house because then I'll know my kids are safe.
Right. Well, in California, you go to jail for that.
Well, you don't go to jail. No, I've been part of this. It's not a criminal offense. It's a civil offense. You get a big fat parking ticket. That's the first thing you get. Most places, it's like a $250 or $500 fine.
But child endangerment or?
It's social host laws. And that's the first line of defense against that. But the larger point here is that young people are influenced by the environments around them. So when we think about youth prevention, certainly parents are important, but parents need a lot of help. Yeah. And the environment can help them if we have reasonable limits on advertising, if we have prices that mark alcohol as a special product. You know, when I was a kid, Coca-Cola and beer were not price competitive. They were clearly very different products. And that's no longer the case. That's the wrong message for kids.
But I think the environment is really important. And you mentioned at the beginning when we started talking, when you said, I went to Dartmouth, implying that's a big alcohol place. And I think that's a lot of people's introduction to an alcohol culture. College. The other one is the military. What is done or what should be done in those environments to not?
So we have a similar phenomenon in college campuses and military bases. They are ringed by alcohol outlets. And that's a first thing that can be done, which is to limit the number of places to drink and to buy alcohol around a base or around a campus. It's just kind of a no-brainer that if you want to reduce the problem, you know, and this is what we try to do with illegals all the time, but we completely ignore it with the legal substances. You got to look, yes, demand reduction is important. Yes, all those prevention, individual level prevention programs are important, but they're completely undercut by our failure to pay attention to the environment, to things like the advertising. I mean, the alcoholic beverage industry is the most effective educator of American youth about alcohol. They flood the airwaves, they flood social media, et cetera. And alcohol educators, parents, schools, people like me, we can't possibly keep up with that. We leveled the playing field in tobacco. And then public health had a fighting chance. It's not like a level informational playing field when it comes to alcohol.
It's interesting because there was an outcry for emphysema and lung cancer. There's not an outcry for cirrhosis.
No, and there should be. There was an outcry for drinking driving, but it's led to the population being so misinformed. When I talk to audiences about alcohol, what they usually start with is their two basic alcohol problems, addiction and drinking driving. And drinking driving causes less than 10% of the adult deaths from alcohol. And addiction.
But the problem with drunk driving is it kills other people who don't have a problem. You're
no,
hurting.
That is the less than 10% of total adult deaths from alcohol caused by drinking driving. It's not to say it's not a problem, but there's so many other things that kill people related to alcohol that we never talk about. That was your point. There is no outcry about liver cirrhosis. There's no outcry about the cancers. Most people don't know that alcohol is a carcinogen, but you know, 5% of cancer cases attributable to alcohol. The heart disease cases. I mean, last year in the U.S. or in an average year, CDC estimates 37,000 people died of heart disease and stroke attributable to alcohol use. We never talk about that.
Yeah.
All right. So now for learning all this stuff from alcohol and you were saying, and really we should learn from tobacco. What do we apply now when it comes to cannabis? Because that's the next big tobacco, big marijuana, big alcohol industry.
So this is a topic of a book that we wrote. It's called Cannabis Moving Forward, Protecting Health. I get no money from it, but it's available on Amazon and from the American Public Health Association Press. What we tried to do in that book is to say, look, we're not going to take a position on legalizing cannabis, but if you're going to legalize, here are the things that you should learn from our experience with alcohol, tobacco, and our experience with cannabis in other countries. And the first thing is just how you set up the whole regulatory apparatus in the first place. And, you know, we identify, I think, 6 different ways that you could regulate cannabis. You could have it just for home cultivation. Okay.
That's the opposite of what Florida wanted to do, right? They only wanted big tobacco to grow it, and you were not allowed to have it for home cultivation.
But you could do home cultivation only. You could do cannabis social collectives, which is what Belgium did for a while. It's what Spain allows in local jurisdictions, and it's one of the options in Uruguay.
That goes against the whole tax thing, right? People, government, the reason they want to legalize marijuana is for the taxes.
There are so many reasons they want to legalize marijuana, but okay, let me just keep walking through these. The third one is a government monopoly. And in alcohol, we love our monopolies because they're economically inefficient, okay? And so it makes it a little bit more expensive. It makes it less easy to get because there are fewer stores, and that is an important source of control. For cannabis, if states did not want to be vulnerable to breaking federal law, there's an arm's length version of monopoly called a public authority. And so in Virginia, that's what they have for distilled spirits. It's not a state agency, but it's completely controlled by the state. Okay. And then the last two are a license system. And you could have a license system that's public health focused, that's run out of your health department, you know, where they put public health first. Or you could have a license system that is basically commercial, where it's left up to the market and minimum amount of regulation. And that's what all the states have done. That is the worst possible system for public health.
I just think that what we're doing with cannabis as far as who is regulating it, we're doing the same thing as we let tobacco regulators dictate the regulation for tobacco. We let the alcohol industry now running alcohol. We let, you know, big pharma and the Sacklers tell us and educate us on, you know,
well, what these regulatory agencies become is they get very complex, and then they're what are known as captive regulators, in that the only people who really understand how to work with them are the people looking to make money off of them, the lawyers in service of the cannabis industry, and very difficult for just folks to employ the levers that are sometimes in place in those systems. But once you've dealt with the overall system, then in alcohol, we think about the world like a marketer. And marketers think in terms of the 4 Ps: product, promotion, place, and price. And there's a whole set of regulatory strategies for each of those. I mean, for products, for cannabis, I mean, give me a break. We're allowing people to sell products that are 99% THC. We have allowed the explosion of gummies and candy lookalikes and all that stuff. So intelligent product regulation, you know, we have some ridiculous products in alcohol, but the cannabis products are so much worse. So in addition to product quality, in addition to looking after things like pesticides, not polluting the supply and all that, there's just, you know, what products are we going to allow on the market? You move on from that to place. So where are we going to allow this? How many of these places are we going to be allowed? And, you know, depending on the state, the number of places you can get cannabis has just absolutely exploded. I talked in Maine a couple of years ago, and they were just all tied in knots because in Maine, they had all these medical dispensaries, and then they legalized for adult non-medical use, and they ignored the medical dispensaries. So suddenly you had full adult non-medical retail outlets opening up in close proximity to the medical dispensaries. It's a mess.
All right. So what did you say? Place, product,
promotion, promotion. You know, yeah. And that's intelligent limits on the advertising. And I mean, the ads that are out there, some of them are ridiculous. And there's a very simple thing that states could
it's advertising. It's also packaging.
It's packaging. Absolutely. And I mean, that sort of bridges between product and promotion. But, you know, the information on the package, users are basically left to titrate themselves. There's no information or very little information about dosage, all that stuff. And then the last one, of course, is price. And that's where tax into play. And it's really tricky with cannabis because legal cannabis is actually cheaper to produce and market than illegal cannabis. So despite the fact that many states say, oh, we've got to eliminate the taxes because we want to get rid of the illegal market, the legal stuff is already cheaper. You have to at least set the tax rate so that it's price competitive, if not slightly more than the illegal supply. You've got more guarantees about quality. You've got easier access to it, all sorts of advantages from the legal supply. And then what we generally find is the price of the illegal supply will tend to follow the price of the legal supply. So if you start slowly raising the price of the illegal supply will come up too. And there's preventive value there. Anyway, yeah. That's my wrap on the four P's for cannabis. But the bottom line, I mean, what we found is just, hey, there's all this evidence out there. There are technologies for regulating intoxicating and potentially addictive substances, and we're ignoring them.
So the writing is on the wall that marijuana may be legalized federally. I think the mistake that certainly California did is that they didn't have good regulation at the same time. Are these the kind of regulations that should be done at the same time?
It would be ideal. The idea with alcohol in 1933 was that there would be states were given a lot of room to experiment. And the idea was there would be a lot of experiments at the state level and states would learn from each other. And then no learning occurred for basically 50 years.
Should FDA be regulating marijuana products?
Well, FDA already does.
Not really, because they say it's illegal, so they can't regulate something that's illegal.
FDA has the ability to declare cannabis-derived medications safe and effective. And there are, I think, three now, maybe only one in the U.S., but anyway, there's a process for that if we think that cannabis is a medicine. Putting cannabis wholesale in the hands of the FDA, I think you'd have to talk to the tobacco control folks. They thought that was going to be great, so much better than being in Treasury. And now all I hear is them complaining. But I think your larger point is if we go to full legalization nationwide, it's going to be very helpful to have some uniformity of regulation of the product across the country. And that I would agree with. The question, big question is, what's that regulation going to be and who's going to drive it? Is the industry going to drive it, in which case they're going to create a playing field where they can make a lot of money? Or is public health going to have a big voice?
Or will it be part of the legalization in the first place? That's where I would want it. Like, if you want it at the same time, not negotiate later, right? If you're going to have legalization, then we're going to have potency limits. We're going to have protection for children.
Yep. And that is what we did with alcohol in 1933. We came out of the gate with very strict regulations. Then we just have to remember to keep them in place. They worked pretty well for decades, but then we forgot about them.
All right. Your advice. We're going to new. I don't know when this episode will air, before, after. The Trump administration, but what is your advice?
Yeah, my advice is on cannabis is two words: go slow. We need to move slowly enough so that we can evaluate what we're doing. One of the standard things I often say about cannabis is in 20 years, we'll have the public health studies to show how big the mistakes were that we made. If we can go slowly enough and devote enough resources to careful evaluation, we can learn as we go. That's not what we're doing now. I do think that the federal level, that Congress is more divided maybe than you think about this. Even moving it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 is attracting a significant amount of opposition, and it probably should. Talking about drug scheduling goes way into the weeds. But, you know, the short version there is, while cannabis may not be heroin, it's also not, you know, on a par with some of the other drugs in Schedule 3.
Well, I don't know. Right? I think 90% THC is on the par of methamphetamine.
Yeah, well, there you go. But it's not like Tylenol with codeine, okay? It's not like anabolic steroids. Those are the things in Schedule 3. So moving cannabis to Schedule 3, I don't think it's a good idea yet. The industry loves it because it would allow them to deduct a lot of what they do as business expenses. And that will enable them to do a whole lot more marketing.
I think they also want, like, well, it's my medicine, so insurance should pay for it. I can't get my insurance to pay for my Synthroid, but
You know, Dr. Lev, you're the doctor in this conversation. I think you have a good response to that.
It's amazing.
Yeah, no, I was amazed at that meeting in Oregon, just listening to your stories of what this looks like in the emergency room. And to me, it's just another example of how not ready we are for this big experiment that we're already in the middle of.
Yeah, but I guess it's hard to be ahead of the curve, but I'm ahead of the curve. It's like, we already have 15 years. You know, when you say go slow, we've already unleashed the beast.
Well, Carol, you're in California. You are at the front end of the curve. There are other places that haven't.
Yeah. Yeah. And but I bet you their local emergency departments are seeing the same kind of stuff I do.
Well, part of that, though, is the legalization of hemp in the Farm Bill in 2018. And I have a colleague in Texas who did this study. He called stores in all 50 states and concluded that we now have a recreational cannabis market in all 50 states because of the non-THC cannabinoids that are being sold.
I call that when Congress is playing doctor, right? They write a rule in that.
Yeah.
Well, this is great. Any other final advice you have? This is great. Great conversation. And we do have to learn from history.
I wish we could learn from history. Part of the problem of learning from history, though, is history is written by the winners. And coming out of Prohibition, the alcohol industry was the winner. And they did a lot. I mean, Sam Bronfman, who built the Seagram's Empire, he was not an alcohol producer. He was a public relations guy. And they helped to tell a story post-Prohibition about what had happened. That simply isn't true. And eventually that word, I hope, will get out. What we ended up with instead was we ended up with the dominant paradigm post-Prohibition being the alcoholism paradigm, which is that most of the population can drink with no problems, and then there's just this tiny sliver that gets addicted.
It sounds the same thing in opiates. Nobody gets addicted to opiates unless you're an addict in the first place. That's what...
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's ridiculous. I mean, CDC finally started doing the research 20 years ago to show that the bulk of the alcohol problems, certainly the bulk of the costs, are not caused by addicts. They're caused by that huge swath, comparatively, of the population that drinks in a risky way occasionally. And the example I like to use is the 17-year-old who downs their first six-pack, gets behind the wheel of a car, and drives it into a tree. Really hard to argue that they're an addict, but they've clearly caused an alcohol problem. And we just have so many people who drink too much occasionally. They cause the bulk of the problems. And things like taxes, making it less available, getting it going after some of the promotion stuff, that helps to create an environment that is less encouraging of occasional heavy use.
Great. And then, David, what is the name of your book that you mentioned?
Yeah, it's Cannabis, Moving Forward, Protecting Health.
All right. That's great. Thank you, David Jernigan. What a lovely conversation. It's fun to talk about alcohol, learn from tobacco, alcohol, watch us repeating the same mistakes, but still hoping to learn from history.
I just so appreciate the work you do. And thanks for everything you do, not only in the ER saving lives, but this kind of thing, getting the word out and hopefully making us a smarter population about these issues.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org and ISAIC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.